From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned Congress that an economic recession is possible. That's no surprise to many people who've been feeling strapped for cash for months now. Many Americans say the shaky economy is their number one issue this election year, but how well do people research the candidates' positions on issues like the economy, and who's responsible for making sure that voters have clear and accurate information? To answer these questions and more, we've got Robert George. He's an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Also joining us, Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Hi, folks.
Hi, Farai.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. So, you know, we're going to talk horse race, but first I want to ask about issues.
Yeah.
I mean,
whatever happened to them?
Exactly. Yeah. Those things. You know, we keep hearing that the economy is the number one issue for Americans right now. But how do people, and I'm going to start with you, Robert, how do you think people get their information? And are people at this point really focused on trying to parse out the candidates' exact plans? Or are they going more on these ideas of who's more charismatic and what are people's character and have they scored points?
I think it's a mixture. I think, though, when it comes to the economy, I think it is the number one issue because it's the thing that the average person encounters or engages in their everyday life on a daily basis. I mean, people are worried about Iraq, but unless they actually have somebody who's a family member in the military or something like that, it's far away from them. Whereas the economy, when they're seeing these headlines about the swings in the stock market, you know, Bear Stearns collapsing and so forth, that is front and center. And so I think they are worried about it, but I'm not quite sure if they are necessarily focused on what Hillary Clinton's 5-point plan is versus Barack Obama's 10-point plan versus John McCain's whatever plan he might have.
The
30-point plan. But so it is the number one issue, but people tend to kind of tune out the actual policy issues of politics until they get closer to making their choice for a specific candidate.
Mary, when you think about how people process information, whose responsibility is it to really make sure that people have information? I mean, is it just the voters' responsibility to hunt through websites? Is it journalists' responsibility? Is it the campaign's responsibility? Who should make sure that voters have the right information?
Well, the campaign obviously will put out what they think will be persuasive. So I wouldn't rely completely on what they put out, although it's good to check it out. Journalists have a responsibility to do it, but where people get their information from, and the voters have a responsibility to find out, but where they get their information from depends on what kind of media they either listen to or watch or read. If you're a newspaper reader and you read major papers, you may see some detailed analysis of something. If you read local papers, usually they don't have much of anything, as I travel around the country, that you could make up your mind about. If you're just an internet news reader and you don't listen to NPR or anything, you may not know specifically what these people are doing, and all you'll catch is the sound bites that come on, you know, the shows on television about their plans, and you'll just have to have sort of a gut reaction, a visceral reaction. Is this person going to fight for me or not? And do they understand my situation or not? And so I think it's up to all three. But it depends on what kind of media you access.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we've got situations where the newspaper as a regular entity or regular medium is sort of falling by the wayside.
Right.
And now some of these younger voters who are the ones very much engaged in, say, the Obama campaign, they may be getting their information from articles posted on Facebook, for example, another internet application. So we don't know how detailed that gets either.
Well, I have to tell you, Farah, that most of the young voters that I encounter aren't making their decision about who they're voting for based on their detailed economic plans. It's their gut and visceral reaction about who's charismatic, who has potential, and who they think they'd like to see in office and live with for 4 years.
Well, I have a bunch of campaign stuff I want to talk about, but just very briefly before we move on to that, Is there anything that has stood out to you, given that the economy is such a huge issue for most people? Has anything stood out among the candidates, distinguishing them in terms of what they presented? I'll go with you first, Robert.
Some of the debates, it's very, very clear that Hillary Clinton still has mastery of the health care issue. Whether you agree with her or not, you can see that that is something that she's incredibly passionate about, and she knows the issue inside and out. So that's something that sort of stands out. I would say Obama's speech on the economy last week kind of stood out in terms of putting him in a rather elevated setting, and it wasn't bad that he was introduced by Mayor Bloomberg as well. But those are the two things that kind of jump out at me right away.
Well, what jumps out at me is that Obama's position is closer to Paulson and the administration's position. A lot of emphasis on regulatory agencies and reorganization. Mm-hmm. As a way to get rid of some of the excesses, say, in the housing problems, which are at bottom at what's going on now with the economy, according to everybody who talks about it. Clinton was more, I'll fight for you and the little guy and save your house for you. And McCain was more, well, the economy will right itself and the free market, in the end will come out. So those stuck out for me in terms of the differences.
He doesn't want to be bailing out either right. lenders or borrowers.
Right.
I want to go to a very specific example of some of the wrangling that's going on right now. There have been these various calls, Hillary Clinton should step out of the race. Oh, no, she shouldn't. Even Barack Obama has basically said, go for it. Let's, fight this out. But we've seen these cases of superdelegates switching sides, and there's an interesting situation. The Missouri representative, Emanuel Cleaver, publicly endorsed Hillary Clinton last year. He still supports her, but he said in an interview that he believes Barack Obama will be the next president. He said he's not shifting his endorsement, but if the race is tight at the convention, he might have to consider voting for Obama for the good of the party. So that's a lot of mixed messages right there. Is that a sign of some softening support?
Can I jump on that one?
Please.
Because I've been following Mr. Cleaver. What has happened to him is he's been beaten up on by people in his district, just like John Lewis was, and
right.
other people who I know personally were beaten up on by people who said, your district voted this way, or your district has, you have black supporters, you have this, you should be with this guy. So I think what he was trying to do was to say something in public to stop people from beating up on him and to sort of play both sides against the middle. And that, I think, accounts for, because he's generally a straight shooter, but he's trying to get these people, off him who keep leaning on him about this. But then I also think, Farah, that the best way to get Hillary Clinton out of the race is to beat her. And I was glad that Obama's campaigning hard in Pennsylvania, because if he were able to beat her there, then we wouldn't have any more calls for who should get out or who should get in. I mean, that would be the end of it. So, but I think calling for her to get out, I was with Jackson's campaign in 1988, and he had about 1,200 delegates. Jackson didn't get out of the race. He had no intention to, and he had great power and influence at the convention and on the platform committee and all the rest of it. So I don't think she's going to get out.
All right. Hillary Clinton is certainly getting political sniper fire from all directions right now. However, I think I have to agree with Mary Frances Berry that Hillary Clinton, is certainly more of a, pardon the expression, a more serious full candidate than Jesse Jackson was in 1988.
Right.
And the margin between Obama and Clinton is so narrow that it would be foolish to drop out now when you've got about 10 primaries and caucuses left. So it's let it play out. As we saw in the last couple of days, there seems to be a little bit of a backlash hitting Hillary Clinton over the Bosnian sniper fire stuff, and her once huge lead in Pennsylvania has now shrunk to single digits. So you're right. If Barack Obama wins Pennsylvania, it will be basically impossible for Hillary Clinton to have any claim on the nomination.
All right, we only got a quick moment to touch on this, but John McCain is doing a week-long biography tour talking about his military service. Mm-hmm. What advantages and disadvantages are there?
Well, Farai, I loved the biography tour at first, and I thought he was going to make great hay out of it. But then I just saw a poll just taken, which indicated that in matchups in Florida, Ohio,
and Pennsylvania,
Hillary Clinton was beating him. Obama was, too, but she was beating him by larger margins. This is while the biography tour is going on. And by the way, it's after Casey has endorsed Obama in Pennsylvania. I thought that was all very interesting. So the biography tour apparently didn't reinforce. I think he should continue it. He should modify it a little bit. He should probably try to raise some money, too, in addition. But McCain has shown us that you can win without money, so maybe he thinks he can win the general election without much money. But I sort of like the biography tour.
I think that's true. Though, actually, the poll in Florida has McCain losing to Clinton but beating Obama by about seven or eight points right now. I think this is actually a good time for him to be doing this biography tour because the Democratic contest has been so prolonged and they're sniping at each other. He has this great opportunity to reintroduce himself to the rest of the electorate and do some fundraising at the same time. So he's got a great story, and Obama is actually being rather canny when he critiques him now. He says, he always starts it with, John McCain is a great American hero, and we respect the service to his country. You know, we love the life he's lived, but we disagree with his policies. And I think that's a rather smart way to try and counter the biography the biography presentation.
Well, Robert and Mary, that's it for today. Always great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Farai. Nice talking to you, Mary.
Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and she spoke to us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Robert George is an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. He joined us from NPR's bureau in New York. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama had his say on race. Now Condi's jumped into the mix. Our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett, is here to explain. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So in an interview last week, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. still has trouble dealing with race because of a national, quote, birth defect. What's been the response to what she said online?
Well, generally, people on our blog agreed with what she said but took issue with her politics. So to sum up, in this interview, Rice said Africans and Europeans founded this country together, Europeans by choice and Africans in chains. That particular birth defect makes it hard for us to confront it. So we talked about her comments and asked the larger question, what will Rice's legacy be? A reader using the alias BC Planning wrote, unfortunately for Rice, I think a lot of people in the black community are going to remember her for shopping for shoes in New York City as New Orleans was drowning during Hurricane Katrina. So there you have it.
There you go. That's a little sharp.
Yeah.
That interview led to a slip-up for CNN anchor Lou Dobbs, perpetually red in the face about something. Tell us about that.
Well, the same day that interview was published, Lou Dobbs talked about it on his show, and he said the problem in the country isn't race, it's the people who talk about race. And then he said this.
And to hear a politician, whoever it may be, talk about how difficult it is to talk about race, well, the heck with them. We're living with the issue of race. We've got to be able to talk about it. And I can guarantee you this, not a single one of these these just ridiculous politicians should be the moderator on the issue of race.
Well, now.
Yeah, exactly. Cotton.
Right. So a lot of people who heard that thought he almost said cotton picking. And a lot of people think that's a racially charged term. And though several bloggers were quick to call Dobbs out, on our blog, people gave him the benefit of the doubt. One reader named Ted said, everyone is wasting time looking for so-called racial bias. Another reader named Evelyn wrote, Dobbs was merely attempting to use the words as a replacement for using profanity. Whatever the case, it doesn't make it any less funny.
So what else is going on our News and Views blog?
Tyler Perry. People always have stuff to say about Tyler Perry. The Hollywood Reporter wrote a front page piece asking if he didn't yet have crossover appeal and why he didn't have it. They said, how black is too black for broader acceptance? And Lolita Amos wrote the best quote, I have to say. She wrote, funny thing is this, no one would have dared continue to say the same thing about a show like Friends, which showed in New York, where there were no people of color, any color, anywhere in one of the most diverse cities in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And our friends at AOL Black Voices have an in-depth interview with Tyler Perry that can be found at our blog, NPR News and Views.
All right. Well, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. Moving on to our bloggers' roundtable, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice talks about America's racial history as a birth defect. So what was she really condemning? Plus, more on Afrocentric baby names. Are they going to keep you from getting a good job, or should folks stop being so snooty and embrace the linguistic creativity? With us, we've got Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com. Pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd, and Terrence Heath. He's an online producer and blogger at Campaign for America's Future, and his personal blog is The Republic of Tea. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
So, you know, last month, Senator Barack Obama had to answer for why he stayed a member of Reverend Jeremiah Wright's Chicago Church, given that Wright made statements that some people felt were anti-American. And Obama gave the landmark speech addressing race in America. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice jumped into the race debate last week, telling the Washington Times that, quote, descendants of slaves did not get much of a head start. And I think you continue to see some of the effects of that. That particular birth defect makes it hard for us to confront it, hard for us to talk about it, etc. Now, some bloggers have suggested Secretary Rice used the term birth defect in reference to racial struggles at the birth of the nation. It's a bit of a convoluted quote. Deborah, what do you think she really meant?
I don't get why it's convoluted. I think that we're all just so trigger happy. To me, I don't see what's confusing. She's saying that slavery was the birth defect in a country that was founded as a refuge. So I think that people are so knee jerk and getting their buttons pushed so quickly. I don't understand why the statement is confusing, and I think people's knees start jerking and they just want the conversation to stop. So, you know, you point out that the person split in infinitive instead of having the conversation that I think she bravely, I mean, this is not the kind of thing you expect from Condoleezza Rice. I think people don't want to have the conversation that she was trying to take part in.
So, Desmond, do you take this as when she says birth defect? It's, you know, the phrase birth of a nation has these horrible connotations in some ways now because of the movie that was about the Klan, a seminal movie that really was a landmark film but also was very racist. But if you take it in the broader context of the birth of the nation and this being a birth defect that marred that birth of a nation, is that what you interpret her saying?
Well, I have to agree with Ms. Dickerson and her assertion. I didn't have a problem with what Condi Rice had stated. I thought that she was pretty accurate. I thought that, if anything, she might have screwed over her perception in as far as white media as versus some of our black media or black folk in certain surroundings. I think that there's a perception of a black conservative, and she doesn't really espouse victimization. So I think at some point it's okay to admit that these things did occur. But where do you go from there? So I think that's where the black conservative movement really is really what that is about.
Terrence, where do you think this leaves us in terms of, for example, perhaps providing room for black conservatives and progressives to have a dialogue about race?
I think what's amazing is that we've heard from some very politically diverse voices like Reverend Wright and Barack Obama and Condoleezza Rice, and they're all saying very similar things. And I think the point of Condoleezza Rice's comment about the birth defect, you know, metaphor is that we're still living with the realities and the consequences of something that this country was born with several hundred years ago.
Speaking of born with, I want to move on to an article that the New York Times did about mixed race identity. You know, there's been, you know, for decades now, there have been conversations about whether or not there is a multiracial identity for people who are part black that's separate from a black identity. I think right now the opinion, you know, is running, yes, you can have a separate multiracial identity. But Deborah, I'm going to start with you, in part because you are the mother of two biracial children. When you think about this ongoing conversation that has been going on for decades but has intensified with the rising number of interracial marriages, with Barack Obama's candidacy, Where's the conversation headed now? Are people being asked to either or about how they identify, or can you be someone like Barack Obama who says he calls himself a black man of mixed heritage?
Right. Or like Tiger Woods calling himself Kablan Asian. I think that until more of these people, more multiracial people speak up and talk about how they want to be considered, I think that that has to happen. And when you've got the old guard, and I think it's probably black and white who just kind of want to split the difference and make you black. How can that be? I mean, my children's father is white, but is all I'm ever supposed to talk to them about is, you know, slavery and Jim Crow and this sort of thing, when there's this German, Scotch-Irish side of them as well, English even on my side. So I think that we've got to resist these essentializations and allow people... I think we have to allow people to tell us who they are. I mean, what if one of my kids turns out to be gay on top of being multiracial? I think they might want to be more identified that way than by race. So I think the more that we talk about these things, the more we see how rigid and kind of meaningless these very limited self-definitions are. And I think the more that people like Obama and Tiger Woods and Mariah Carey, people like that, talk about it and demand to be understood in something approaching a meaningfully complicated way, I don't think we're there yet, but I think these conversations are moving us forward.
Terrence, you are a father as well, and you are gay. You're, you and your partner are raising your children. And when you think about this concept of identity, what do you think about the idea of identities that you have and you know about in yourself and identities that people see in you? You know, some people can see a mixed race person and they'll see black. That's what they'll see. Other people might see the same person and say, oh, that person is biracial, or they might not even know. And I think that one of the sort of sticking points in this conversation over identity has been some of the tensions in the discussion over whether the gay rights model is similar to the civil rights model. Is there a level of identity that is seen as opposed to identity that's expressed? So when you think about all of those things in the blender, no matter what you think of yourself as, how important is it that other people may view you a certain way? If you say that you're multiracial, but you're driving through some town and somebody calls you the N-word, you know, that's something that might just happen.
Well, first of all, I'm a huge advocate of self-determination. People decide what their own identities are. But I think in this country, we have this need for people to be one thing, or if there are multiple identities in play, to prioritize one over the other. And my attitude, my approach is that I am me, all of me, every facet of me, every day. The reality that I have lived with, and that I know that my sons, I'm raising two African-American boys that my partner and I adopted, I know the reality that they're going to face is what people will see. And I hope I can pass on to them what I've had to learn learn myself, and that is that there is more to me than what people see, and to not let what people see define me in terms of what they're going to project. But at the same time, I know certain things that as an African American man, I am going to have to deal with or at least keep in mind.
Desmond, how does this whole idea of what is seen as opposed to what is, internally felt or internally identified with play out in politics? For example, black conservatism. You know, people may look at an African-American and assume, okay, well, that person's got to be a Democrat. And there's that level of identification that might happen that even extends outside of, you know, the basic racial issues.
Well, I think that... if anything, one of the things that I think that African Americans we suffer from is a lack of multiple voices or a myriad of voices. I think if we see more people out there talking about this kind of thing, I think that you'll be able to have more clarity on it. My feelings as far as racial identity, as far as again going back to African Americans, race has always been a social, socio-political construct anyway, And I think in some respects, it's also moot in regards to black people because Dr. Henry Louis Gates had a recent special. He's been doing this African-American Lives. And he says, and you know, he was able to tell these notables, whether it was Chris Rock or Tina Turner or a number of other people, their lineage. And with as Africans in this country, we've seen how we all look. And it's jarring to see the reaction of someone, let's say a Chris Rock who is brown complected, to be shown a white antecedent two or three generations removed. So to me, whether we discuss Obama's identity or not, it's really a moot subject. It's always going to be based on who you look like, and it's going to be that whole quick reaction as to okay, this is who I perceive you to be. If a policeman is going to accost you, or if you're trying to get a cab. There you go. And I think Obama has already spoken about that. So for the life of an African-American person, it really is moot. We have all this admixture in our bloodline anyway.
I want to go back to the well on something that we talked about in February. Call this a repeat by popular demand.
I'm very familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. I know you've been getting a lot of mail about this. What's in a name? You know, we asked whether African Americans pay an economic price for having distinctly ethnic or black sounding names. And you were on the show. You said if you have a name like Lakeisha, you were in trouble, basically. What kind of reactions have you been getting to that? And how do you respond to people who've been sending you tons of mail?
Well, listen, I'm going to remain steadfast in my beliefs because I go by what I've read and what I see anecdotally, and you know, I got a lot of positive responses from that. A lot of people said, "I'm glad that you said what you said." And I had some people that were just very irate. Probably someone who was a Daquan or Deshaun was probably angry with me. Now, to clarify what I said last time, I'm not condemning a person because of their name. It would be stupid to say that because you are named something that equals problems for you in life, but I think that it is an indicator for where you may go in life. It doesn't mean that you should be hampered by it, but also we should use some level of discernment. I mean, there's a definite difference between someone who's like Barack Obama as opposed to Shanae. Barack Obama, this person, he can go to his African grandmother in Kenya and touch her. I can't do that. I'd have to take a swab, like I mentioned before, to find out who I'm related to.
Oh, so, my gosh. Well, we don't have too much time. I want to get the other two folks in here. But, you know, Terrence, it strikes me that people cross the name line both ways. There are people who may sort of anglicize their urban fabulous names. And then there's other people who adopt African names. And so, you know, is it really just about choice? Is it about, you know, you're born with a name, but that's not the one that you have to keep, and you can make an economic or a cultural decision? Or is there something deeper to it?
You know, there are a lot of things in play. I mean, when we were deciding what to name our two boys, we chose very, I don't know what you'd call them, very standard or anglicized names because that was what we liked. And I think part of it is what people like. But when you are talking about African-sounding names versus actual African names, I think there's also a cultural yearning at play, a desire to have a connection to a past and to a history that we don't necessarily get a lot of in this country.
Deborah, just quickly, do you think that people who have names that are, you know, kind of invented, Africanized, and who may not be treated as seriously in the workplace, according to studies, should say, hey, you know what? I need the money. I'm just going to change myself from Deshaun to Sean.
I am not sure that people are choosing these names, A, because they think they're quasi-African, and B, because they feel a need for some sort of connection to Africa. I have, maybe I've missed some research, but from what I can tell, the names are just being chosen sort of by the, now, of course, Raheem and names like that are different, but, you know, Najon and my son is in the first grade and everybody in there but him has a name with an apostrophe in it, you know.
Oh.
So I'm not sure people are hearkening back to Africa, but that's a really tough one. Should you change your name? That
right.
is... I maybe use your initials or something, but
people have done that.
That is a really, really hard one because you're turning back on your mama.
You don't want that resume talked
out. We gotta wrap it up here, but we're gonna get some more mail. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Terrence Heath's personal blog is The Republic of Tea. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Pop culture critic Desmond Burton runs the blog Afro Nerd. He was at our New York studios. And Deborah Dickerson is author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com, and she was at WAMC in Albany, New York. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. 49 years ago, Clarence Garrett dropped out of college so he could make money to raise his four children. Then, once he was in his 80s, he decided not to let his dream slip away. In 2006, he enrolled as a full-time student at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In December, he finally graduated more than half a century after his journey began. I got a chance to talk to Clarence Garrett not too long ago. First, he took me back to his childhood in segregated Baltimore.
When I was a boy, I was the worst thing you could possibly think of. I didn't want to go to school. I hooked school. I was a terrible boy.
Terrible as in mischievous? What kind of terrible?
Wouldn't study my homework, cut school, you know.
What changed your mind? Because you did start college for a while.
Well, ever heard of the three C's? Civilian Conservation Corps. That was started by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at the time the President of the United States. And he started that program to get young boys like me off the street and try to put them in places where they could learn a trade. And I joined that, and that's when I started to learn about gasoline engines, diesel engines, and heavy equipment.
That probably served you pretty well when you went into the military. How did you get into the military, and what did you do once you went in?
After I left the CC camp, I went to the Norfolk Navy Yard in Portsmouth, Virginia. That's where I learned to run engine lathe and made parts for ships. And I wanted to volunteer for the Army, but I was drafted. And I drafted and was sent to Camp Ellis, Illinois, where I took my basic training and went to overseas in a quartermaster service company in Germany, first France.
What was it like in the military? You mentioned that you were in segregated schools. How did people of different races get along in the military when you were in?
There was no such thing as a mixed company. And the companies that I were in at that time were all black, and they had white officers. Of course, you could still see the segregation in some of the fellows was that were from the South, you know. That they I recall one incident in Frankfurt, Germany, where during the mess period, this was a sergeant first class, and he was sitting at the table dining, and I went to get my tray, and to come to sit down at the same table, he looked at me and said, "There's other seats elsewhere." I said, "You mean to tell me, man, you come all the way over here and want to start that crap?" And we got into a confrontation when we got outside. I didn't strike him, but I was waiting for him to strike me. And if he did, all hell would have broke loose.
So you were ready to stand up for yourself?
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Do you ever talk to the students that you went to college with recently, students who were maybe sometimes 60 years younger than you, about what you have lived and what you have gone through? Do you ever tell them these kinds of stories?
In some of my classes, some of the fellows would ask me about the segregated South. And I would reveal to them, like in one instance, we had a history major, and he was just tickled to death to learn this stuff firsthand from somebody who had actually been through it. Example, I used to tell him that at the Norfolk Navy Yard, the drinking fountains and the laboratories were all segregated. Black, colored water, and colored bathrooms, white bathrooms. And the white water always broke down, and they drank the colored water.
All right, let's flash forward a little bit to what your life was like. You had served in the Army and then the Army Reserves, and you began school classes, but you dropped out to help your family. Did you ever feel, wow, I have missed my chance?
No, ma'am. I never felt that way. You know, having the kids and you want them to be educated, knowing what it is like to be not educated.
Did you ever think, I'm going to be older than most of the professors, let alone the students? Did you ever worry about that?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. To be honest with you, when I was in class, I thought I was young as the youngest student there. I just enjoyed myself immensely. I felt not out of place. I felt in place, and we got along just like peas in a pod.
What were some of the challenging parts of school? What did you find the hardest?
Reading, studying my lessons. You know, because I had to read more, you know. And, of course, you know, as you get older, your short-term memory sort of fails you once in a while. So to make sure that you got the material where you could reproduce it, you had to study a little harder and do a little more research.
So tell me what graduation day was like.
Ooh, the best day of my life, I guess. Life doesn't get any better. Life doesn't get any better. With my family there or my friends cheering me on, I felt like I was 16 years old. What a day, what a day. I was happy. Everybody was pleased. They gave me a good ovation. I really enjoyed it. I really did. I cannot explain to you in words my feelings.
So if there's somebody out there listening, and I'm sure there are people who are over 70 or over 80 and who have thought, well, I'd like to go back and pick up that extra degree, but I don't know if it's practical, why would you tell them that it's something that's good to do?
First thing, why would it not be practical? If it's something someone wants and something they have missed all their lives and they know as they're getting older that they're getting closer to the end of the line and something they want to do before they pass on. You know, you didn't come here to stay and you will perish. So if that's the last thing you wanted to do, then I should do it. But first I want to remind you that you must have good health, you must have good stamina, and the interest has to be there. If the interest is not there, forget about it. You're wasting your time.
And as far as health goes, what's your best advice for how to stay healthy?
First, I would like to say I have never had a headache in my life. I don't take no medications for nothing. All my vital signs are good. You have to pay attention to what you eat, not eat too much fat. Watch your salt intake. Watch your alcohol intake. Stay away from drugs and smoking.
Well, that's good advice all around. Thank you, Mr. Garrett.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
87-year-old Clarence Garrett is the oldest graduate in the history of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. What if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today? Would he be proud of America's progress on civil rights? Maybe he'd say we let him down by allowing the activism that fueled his movement to die from neglect. And what would King think of Obama's historic White House bid? Could he tell us anything new about his own assassination? In his new book, What Would Martin Say?, Clarence B. Jones uses King's life and speeches to guess where the late Reverend might stand on the Iraq War, affirmative action, and black leadership. Jones knew King well. He was one of the Reverend's closest advisors. Jones even helped write the famous I Have a Dream speech. Clarence Jones, welcome to News and Notes.
Hi, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So you open your book with a story, and you talk about meeting with Dr. King, actually telling him no to something he was asking you to help him with. First, describe the meeting, and then how did you have the guts to refuse Dr. King?
Well, you know, the meeting arose out of the fact that in February of 1960, Dr. King was indicted by the state of Alabama for perjury and state income tax. And he called me and said they needed someone to essentially be a legal gopher. I'd just gotten out of law school in 1959. It was 1960. I was just starting out. And he wanted me to just come to Montgomery, Alabama, and help him. And as much as respect as I had for him, I simply said I couldn't do it. And one night, I opened my door, and there are two men standing at my door. One is a medium, tall man on a stocky with a hat on, white shirt, skinny tie, dark suit. And he said, Mr. Jones, I'm Martin King. And this is Reverend Bernard Lee. I said, yes, I've been expecting you. So we come into the house. And I was meeting this person for the first time. Now, my wife, God rest her soul, she's deceased. She was very enamored of him. And he said he wanted to stop by because Judge Delaney had told him so much about me. But more importantly, he wanted to be sure that I understood what the needs of the movement were. The needs of the movement were they needed young Negro professionals. And I said, Dr. King, I'd love to help you and pleased to help you, but there's no way I can do that. I mean, I'd help you any way I can from Los Angeles, and so I'm sorry I can't. And so he left, and my wife was somewhat enamored of him, and she turned to me and said, well, what are you doing that's so important that you can't go down there for a few weeks? And so in my defense, perhaps, you know, overly defensive, I said, Ann, just because some Negro preacher got his hand caught in a cookie jar, that's not my problem. She said, I can't believe you. I said, well, he wouldn't have been indicted if he wasn't guilty. She said, what?
So how did it get to the point where you got on the bus, so to speak?
His secretary, Dora McDonald, called back and said, oh, Mr. Jones, I never met her, heard her over the phone. She says, you know, Dr. King, he enjoyed so much his visit with you. He's a guest preacher over in Los Angeles, and he wanted you to come and see him and hear him preach on Sunday. And after I got the message, I told my wife verbatim what the message was from Dora McDonald. And her reaction, again, she went on the offensive. She says, well, you may not be going to Montgomery, but you are going to that church. So I go to this church, Reverend H.B. Charles, I think is the name of the church, and I go into this church. I'm sitting there about the 25th row and so forth, and Dr. King gets up after he's introduced, and he gets up and he says, brothers and sisters, the text of my sermon today is the role and responsibility of the Negro professional to aid our less fortunate people who are struggling in the South. And he was saying how we, you know, you here who've been so fortunate, you've got to help. We need you. And then he pauses and he says, for example, there's a young man sitting in this church today. My friends in New York, whom I respect, they tell me that this young man's brain has been touched by God. But this young man told me something about himself, and I had a chance to meet him. His father was a chauffeur and a gardener. His mother was a maid and a cook. And I said, oh, Lord. And I started, like, trying to hide in my seat. But he started really telling the story that was classic of many professionals. If somebody went and worked for them, either their parents or grandparents, and made it possible for them to have an education. And then he paused again. He said, you know, but he has forgotten from whence he came. And I thought for a moment, because a video of my mother, particularly my father, came up. And I started to cry. I mean, tears came down. So after the service is over, didn't say a word. I just walked over to him, put my hand in his hand, and said, Dr. King, when do you want me to leave?
Mm. And then you went on to work on what is Reverend King's most famous or certainly most quoted speech, the I Have a Dream speech. Now, today you can hear that speech used in a lot of different contexts. It's in some ways become background music for Black History Month, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as someone who worked on this speech and saw the impact it had on America, what do you think when you hear the speech parsed out into little bits and used to justify any number of things, including things that Reverend King wouldn't have supported?
Okay, first, just very briefly, when I say worked on the speech, it was a collective effort in August, and I don't want to take too much time because of limitations of time, but on August 27th, 1968, the night before, a group of us met, sitting with Martin in the lobby as to what he was going to say. But its significance today is that that speech was a call to moral arms, like a call to arms for America. And isn't it almost prophetic that here we are today in a presidential campaign? And by the way, unless Senator Obama or Senator Hillary Clinton have any doubt, it was the transformative effect of Martin King that made it possible for a African-American man and a white woman to run to be elected as president of the United States.
Mr. Jones, when you think about the issues of justice, and for so long, we as African Americans have, many of us have debated, what does justice mean in this life? What does justice mean in the next life? Do you think that there is racial justice? Do you think that there will be racial justice on this earth?
Yes, I do. I believe that we are at a profound transition point. Martin King would say today, there's no way we can make the transition to the 21st century unless we leave the baggage of slavery and racism behind. And I think, to talk about current events, I think that he would both be disappointed and applaud what's going on in the political discourse. He would be disappointed because when Senator Obama is criticized in his speech he gave in Philadelphia, Martin would say, well, hold on, America seems to be deeply afflicted by amnesia about how it treated this African-American people over the past 20th century. But I think he'd applaud the fact that Senator Obama did what should have been done earlier and needs to be done. You see what Senator Obama did? He walked into the National Living Room of America, and he acknowledged and then talked to the 800-pound gorilla of race relations that everybody knew was sitting in there for the 20th century. Senator Obama says, hold on, Mr. Gorilla. We're talking about building a new house in the 21st century. And in this new house we're building, Mr. Gorilla, there ain't no room for you. So you've got to get out. We've got to put you behind because we cannot construct the new house and have you sit in the living room again.
On that note, and it's a hopeful note, Clarence Jones, thank you.
Thank you.
Clarence B. Jones is the author of What Would Martin Say? Jones was a principal advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from 1961 until King's death in 1968. Today, he's a scholar in residence at the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. And he joined me from our NPR studios in New York. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.